This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow on Talk of the Nation, we'll cover the men behind Superman with the history of the comic book industry, from its roots in hooch smuggling and girly magazines to its modern-day moguls. And now we turn to another flying man in a cape of a very different sort, that ghastly Transylvanian Count Dracula. Hundreds of films have introduced generations of moviegoers to some very different images of the ashen-skinned Count and his strange appetites.
I am Dracula.
Welcome to my home. Enter freely of your own will and leave some of the happiness you bring.
Count Dracula?
I am Dracula.
Who are you?
I apologize. I assumed you knew. I am Dracula.
Get out!
That was Bela Lugosi from the 1931 version, Gary Oldman and Francis Ford Coppola's 1992 retelling, and more recently Sarah Michelle Gellar from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. With Halloween lurking just behind the next creaky door, we've invited horror scholar David Skull to join us for a discussion of celluloid vampires. His book, Hollywood Gothic, The Tangled Web of Dracula from Novel to Stage to Screen, was recently reissued. He joins us now from the studios of member station KPCC in Pasadena, California. Good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Well, thank you for having me.
And we'd like to hear from all of you as well. If you have a favorite little-known depiction of Count Dracula to tell us about or a question about the Count's antics, give us a call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or you can send us email, totn@npr.org. And David Skull, the earliest film adaptation of Dracula was the 1922 German silent picture Nosferatu. Now, the name Dracula is never used in that film. How come?
Well, it was used on the original credits, which got its filmmakers into a lot of trouble because it was a pirated, unauthorized version. And they may have gotten away with it, but they put right on the titles, freely adapted from Bram Stoker's Dracula, which sent his widow, Stoker's widow, on the warpath. And she ultimately had the film declared a plagiarism, and the German courts ordered all prints destroyed.
And it was out of circulation, hard to see for a long time.
A long time. It's only been completely restored in recent years, and quite beautifully so. But it wasn't taken seriously until only quite recently.
Well, the two men who are basically behind that film, Albin Grau and F.W. Murnau, real characters.
Oh, totally. There was a recent film, Shadow of the Vampire, that tried to put forth the theory that Max Schreck, the actor who played the vampire, was really a vampire.
That's
He wasn't, of course. Actually, the story behind the making of Nosferatu would have made a better dramatic film, I think. But it remains one of the classics of German expressionism and one of the creepiest movies ever made.
Hmm. Well, a flash forward a little bit to Bela Lugosi, and he, of course, became the defining Dracula, but was that just because it was a Hollywood movie?
Well, he actually was from Transylvania himself, and there's an interesting link between Lugosi and Bram Stoker's novel. Stoker would never have really recognized Lugosi as playing the character he wrote. His Dracula was this hideous old man who grew younger as he drank blood, but he never became attractive. He certainly wasn't seductive, and he didn't have any, manners. But when Dracula was adapted for the stage, which is where Lugosi came in, mm-hmm. the character was recast as the kind of character you could plausibly invite into a drawing room for a mystery melodrama, you know, set in a drawing room, as they all were in the 20s. And that's where the cape and the unctuous manners and everything about Lugosi, you know, came in. Mm-hmm. But Lugosi really is the one actor who played Dracula who harkened back to the late 1800s. And that, of course, was the theatrical milieu that Stoker drew much of his inspiration from.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, the English language version of that Lugosi film Dracula is the classic version.
Yes.
And they made another version, though, at night.
They made a wonderful Spanish language version at night on the same sets with the same costumes, but with a completely different cast and crew. And it was in many ways a rival production. And I recount the whole soap opera of this in Hollywood Gothic. Technically, it's much, much better than the Lugosi film. And fans have always felt that if only Lugosi had been directed and photographed in, you know, the manner of the Spanish language film, we would have even a more memorable horror classic today.
Email question. Is it true that the origin of Dracula began with a European king who ate the flesh and drank the blood of his enemies? This from Edai Kamal.
No, not quite. Bram Stoker had already outlined and was working on his vampire novel when he stumbled across the name of a 15th century Romanian warlord whose name happened to be Dracula. But he wasn't inspired to write his novel. He just thought it would add a little bit of, you know, historical verisimilitude. But the historical Dracula, although very bloodthirsty and known also as Vlad the Impaler for his favorite method of dispatching his enemies, had no historical connection with vampire legends or superstitions.
Bloodthirsty in the old-fashioned metaphorical sense,
yes.
Not in the vampire.
Well, in the very literal sense, yeah, yes.
Yeah. Let's get a caller on the line, and we'll go to Paul, who's calling from Long Island.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a two-part question. I was wondering if you could speculate why the fascination with this Dracula character has gone on for so long. And I was curious to know if there were other literary figures, Dracula or, I don't want to call him a monster, but monsters or creatures like that that may have existed around the time of Bram Stoker's novel that may have since been forgotten. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for the call, Paul.
Well, Dracula has persisted, and at this time of the year, you know, Halloween falls just before Election Day, and so it's almost irresistible to point out that Dracula is the perfect politician. He's been all things to all people, and I think this has a lot to do with his longevity. You know, the novel wasn't considered a literary masterpiece of any kind in its time, and I think that's led all the adapters to take a really free hand with changing Dracula's appearance and his persona over the years. And he adapts and he adapts and he adapts. And I think that in terms of other horror characters, he's very closely related to the Frankenstein monster. And in fact, the two characters had their embryonic origins at the same literary house party that Mary Shelley threw with Lord Byron and Percy Shelley back in 1816. And these two characters have been in kind of a perpetual orbit with each other ever since. Whenever one's on stage, the other one is just waiting in the wings, rather waiting to come out. And filmmakers and stage producers, whenever they approach one of these characters, inevitably they go to the other one as their next project. They're considered good luck in theatrical parlance.
We're talking with David Scull, the author of Hollywood Gothic, The Tangled Web of Dracula from Novel to Stage to Screen, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Juliet calling from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hi there.
Hi.
How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good. I just called to talk about my favorite Dracula.
And that is?
It's a production by the Moving Poets Theater of Dance, which is being performed in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Even as we speak?
As we speak. It's on this Thursday and Saturday nights at the Hartwitson Gallery. It's a great production where it combines dance and theater to, you know, it's a very good, sensuous, provocative portrayal of Dracula.
Julietta, I take it that's a plug for the performance.
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Thank you very much for the phone call.
Thanks.
Neil, it should be a plug for the theatricality of Dracula, because some of the best adaptations of the film, of the novel, have not been done on film, but on the stage, especially in dance and ballet and opera. It's a marvelously inspiring piece to theater folk.
Email question from Eric Knudsen in Oakland, California. Does your guest know about the wonderfully cheesy Dracula films made by Britain's Hammer Studios in the 60s and 70s? I'm talking about such treats as Brides of Dracula and Countess Dracula.
Oh, well, I spent a whole, additional chapter updating all the Hammer films, which I grew up with. I mean, I grew up in the 50s and 60s when these films were being made. And they, again, helped keep Dracula alive, especially in the person of Christopher Lee, the wonderful British actor,
mm-hmm.
who for the first time brought a real kind of commanding sexuality to the part. Previously, Dracula hadn't. It was difficult even to look at Lugosi as being really sexy in a modern sense. But Christopher Lee next to Lugosi really stuck Dracula on the map and, did about 8 or 9 films.
Here's another email question. Eric in West Lynn, Oregon. I saw a cable listing recently for something called Old Dracula starring David Niven. Is that worth seeing for any reason?
It's not one of my favorites, but it shows you, the lengths to which Dracula is expandable. He can be played for the broadest comedy and for the most terrifying horror.
Mm-hmm.
And David Niven had fun with that film. It's not one of the greatest Dracula pictures, but a lot of people enjoy it.
Okay. Let's talk with Chris. Chris is calling from Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, Chris.
This is Andy.
Oh, Andy, I apologize. Go ahead.
That's okay. How are you, Neil?
Very well, thank you.
I have a quick question, and I can take my answer off the air when I'm done, but I know that, or at least I think I know that, the myth of Dracula was started from Vlad the Impaler.
Right.
I'm wondering if how much of what we think and what we know of vampires today is because of Dracula and Bram Stoker's Dracula, or how much was the original legend? And thank you.
Okay, Chris, thank you.
Oh, well, it was mostly Bram Stoker. He did only the most cursory kind of research into the historical character who shared the name of Dracula. But all of the conventions about vampires that we live by today were really the gift of the literary imagination of Bram Stoker. Even the idea of the jugular vein as the place where the vampire would attack. Previously, it had always been above the heart, because the heart was supposedly the seat of the soul and the emotions and the passions and that sort of thing. But Stoker kind of medicalized it and animalized it. He was very interested in Darwinian theory, and his Dracula was a Darwinian monster, an animal who spent no time, seducing his victims. His idea of a social call was to smash through your bedroom window in the form of a wolf.
And here's an email from Asad Kashigi in Cleveland. I'm wondering if your guest is familiar with the film from Pakistan from the late 60s, The Living Corpse, quite faithful to many aspects of the original story, except it was switched to modern times and the basis of vampirism was an experimental immortality formula. It's received many high marks from Dracula aficionados. Have to admit, I enjoyed it quite a bit myself.
I haven't seen it. I know of it, and I've been looking for a copy, and I hope I'll be able to get my hands on one. But there have been so many adaptations around the world. There was a wonderful version done in Turkey in the 1950s that was much closer to Bram Stoker's novel than many of the Western versions. So it's Dracula has appeared in almost 200 films. Nothing, no English novel has been adapted as many times. Nothing in Shakespeare has been adapted as many times as Dracula.
And it turns out that the only thing that is undead is his agent, his literary agent. Thank you very much, David
Yes.
Scull.
Thank you.
David Scull is the author of Hollywood Gothic, The Tangled Web of Dracula from Novel to Stage to Screen. He joined us from member station KPCC in Pasadena. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.